This is the 2011 West Coast School of the Prophets. Our theme for the weekend is The Day of the Lord Draweth Nigh. Our speaker is Brother Carl Perry from the Salisbury Ecclesia in Adelaide, Australia. This is session number 7, Current Events, and it's entitled Distress of Nations with Perplexity. The reading was Joel chapter 3. Brother Carl.
Okay, thank you, Brother Tony. We're going to look at two major prophecies this afternoon. One is Joel chapter 3, and the other is the Olivet Prophecy. And the reason why we're going to look at these two prophecies in particular is because it sets up an amazing amount of information about what we could expect just prior to Armageddon and the return of Jesus Christ. So while traditionally we may use Joel chapter 3 to describe the process of Armageddon, and that's an excellent way of using Joel 3, there is nevertheless embedded within this chapter enough information to tell us what to expect in the world prior to the Lord's return. And that's why Joel chapter 3 is of interest to us. So let's just have a look at some of the issues in Joel chapter 3. For behold, in those days and in that time when I shall bring again or turn back the captivity of Judah and Jerusalem. Now the first thing we need to understand is that there is a distinction made between Judah and Jerusalem. The second thing is that the days of Joel 3 are defined as the time when the Jewish people are back in the land. But it came in two parts, Judah first, Jerusalem second. This, in fact, this chapter is where the Lord got Luke 21:24 from. Jerusalem shall be trodden down the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. Because this is talking about time periods in those days, and it's talking about the restitution of Judah and Jerusalem. And the Lord picked on this point about Jerusalem. Well, in the late 1800s, there was a man called Theodor Herzl. He was a newspaper man, he was a reporter, and he was covering a very high-profile trial in France, Paris, France. There's a man there called Dreyfus, Charles Dreyfus. He was a Jew, and he was an officer of the French forces, and he was falsely accused of treason against the French state. He went on trial, he was accused, stripped of his epaulets, court-martialed, imprisoned. And Theodor Herzl was a Jewish reporter from Vienna, Austria, covering the trial. And he was in the square in Paris where they stripped the epaulets off Dreyfus. And as this man's being court-martialed, there's a chant which begins to grow amongst the French people looking at all this. And the chant was, death to the Jews, death to the Jews, death to the Jews. And Theodor Herzl, being a Jew, was taken back by this. How can it be that in an enlightened society, in the late 1800s, in France, which is an enlightened country, there can be this hostile anti-Semitism in this civilized country? Death to the Jews! And it dawned on this man that the Jews would never, ever be safe, even in the most enlightened parts of Europe, unless they had their own homeland. Isn't that amazing? And so he put a paper out called the Judenstaat, the Jewish state. And in the Judenstaat, he argued the case for a Jewish homeland, a place where Jews could at last find security. In the late 1800s, they held their first Zionist conference in Basel in Switzerland, and so the Zionist movement began. What is interesting about this man is that as momentum was building and he gathered prominent Jews, wealthy Jews, to support the Jewish state concept, he began to petition the Kaiser in Germany for some real estate in Palestine. Slowly by slowly, the Rothschilds and some of the wealthy Jews began to buy tracts of land in Israel, in Palestine, in an attempt to re-establish Jews. And small dribs and drabs of families did go back. All that happened in Robert Roberts' day, by the way. And Robert Roberts of the Christadelphian had an appeal to send Jews back to the land and to buy tracts of land in Palestine, because to them this was the fulfillment of all the prophecies of the Jewish return. Isn't that interesting? Dozen families here, dozen families there, and the Brotherhood in England is absolutely on its toes in excitement because this is the fulfillment of the Jewish return. How little did they know that many, many years later they would come back in their millions. What's interesting about this, though, is that as the congresses went each year, particularly in the early 1900s, it became apparent to Theodor Herzl that, you know, buying tracts of land in Palestine was all very well, but we need a political solution here. Another man, Chaim Weizmann, was also a prominent Jew. He was the British chemist who discovered acetone, which is a part of acetate, which is a part of gunpowder. And this was a very advanced discovery which the British government used, and Chaim Weizmann was very popular with the British government. And Chaim Weizmann and Theodor Herzl actually clashed. Chaim Weizmann said, we must go to Palestine. This is the Jewish route. This is the Jewish homeland. And Theodor Herzl said, we can't get Palestine. I want to push for Uganda in Africa. Can you imagine a Jewish state in the middle of Africa? Suddenly, when Theodor Herzl proposed a movement in the next Jewish conference, Zionist conference in Basel, he died unexpectedly, was removed out of the way by the hand of Providence, and Chaim Weizmann's proposition of a Palestinian solution ruled the day. Isn't that interesting? That God would use this man to get the thing going, to get the momentum going, to get the Zionist Congress going, the concept of Zionism and Jewish state going, but when he deflected from the land of Israel, which the prophets had said would happen, he was taken out of the way prematurely. And the idea of a political solution in Israel, in Palestine, came to pass. Fascinating story itself. And God said in Joel chapter 3, there will come a day when I will turn back the captivity of Judah now. Captivity. Where does that word appear in the New Testament in the context of prophecy? Exactly. Keep your hand there. Come to Luke 21. Just a little word, but it's enough for the Lord to seize on that word and make a prediction. Right, as a reward, could you please read Luke 21:24? Yep, Luke 21:24. Yep.
21:24. For there shall be great tribulation.
Sorry, Luke 21:24. Okay, you can just pause there.
Sorry?
They shall be led away captive into all nations. That word came straight out of Joel chapter 3, verse 1. Because Joel 3 talked about the reversal of the captivity. And if there's a reversal of the captivity, there must be a captivity. And that's why Jesus Christ could understand Joel 3 and say that they would be led away captive into all nations. The Lord read his Bible very carefully. Well, he was the Word made flesh, wasn't he? Isn't that interesting? Okay. We know, therefore, that Joel chapter 3 is at least going to start for us in 1948. Because that was the date when the Jewish state was established. We've seen, haven't we, the photograph of General Allenby walking to Jerusalem. And here's the other famous photograph of David Ben-Gurion standing up and proclaiming the State of Israel in May 1948, underneath a picture of Theodor Herzl, Zionist leader. And that remarkable and wonderful event known by the prophets in which the State of Israel was proclaimed. And I don't know whether, have you heard the tape recordings of the United Nations vote and the State of the Jewish State? It's gripping stuff, isn't it? Really gripping stuff. Afghanistan, no. And on it goes. Russia, yes. Britain, abstain. I always know the recording off by heart. It's a fantastic recording. And finally, when the Jewish state was proclaimed, in the streets of Tel Aviv, the horror dancing and the euphoria that after 2,000 years of statelessness, pogroms, persecutions, the Jewish homeland is a reality. And then the sirens are heard and the Arabs attack to try and destroy the Jewish state. But God had said in Joel chapter 3 and verse 1, I will return the captivity of Judah. Amazing story, isn't it? A miracle. But verse 1 also says, I will turn back the captivity of Jerusalem. And that's where Luke 21:24 comes in. Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles until. How did he know there would be an until? Because Joel chapter 3 and verse 1 said that Jerusalem would be back in Jewish hands. And the great stories of the Six-Day War, you know, the lightning attacks across the Sinai Peninsula, the way in which they just demolished the Egyptian army, and the old photographs of all the Egyptian boots lining the highway as they ran back to Egypt in bare feet. The tremendous stories of the way in which the Israeli Air Force decimated the Egyptian Air Force in a preemptive strike. All of those things. Great stories. The hand of God behind all that. And at last, in the Six-Day War, Jerusalem was taken. Fighting for Jerusalem. And that last photograph, a very famous photograph of hardened, battle-weary paratroopers standing before their most holiest wall. No longer the Wailing Wall, now the Western Wall. As they tuck their little prayers in the crevices, weeping openly and unashamedly that at last Jerusalem was in the hands of the Jewish people. What an amazing story. And it's all in one verse of Scripture. You know, incredible. The promise of God doing that. And all of that, though, contributed to this sense of self-achievement that dominated the Israeli people. And they still have that sense of self and self-achievement. We know that. There's no reliance on God. Blindness in part has happened to the Jews. But what a great story that is. Just one verse. And history providing such a wonderful and thrilling fulfillment of that. Now, I will reverse the captivity of Judah and Jerusalem, we have seen in Luke 21:24. In verse 2, though, we now come down to our age. From verse 2 onwards, we now have the events that are going to lead to Armageddon. And embedded in these verses, we can extrapolate some information about events we expect to see just prior to Armageddon. Verse 2 says, I will also gather all nations and will bring them down into the valley of Jehoshaphat. The first thing we note is all nations. Now, question, do you think every nation on earth will have a part in that military expedition?
No.
Okay, why do you say no, Jimmy? Okay. Any other comments? Jason?
Verse 2 explains who it is at the end. Those who have scattered his people.
Right. The all nations is defined by the verse as those who are involved in the scattering and parting of Israel's land. Okay, so the context defines all nations. It doesn't mean Ecuador necessarily, or Iceland necessarily. However, the fact that we have a body of people who are called the United Nations, in which virtually every country is represented, is, I think, significant. Anyone know how often the Jewish state gets voted against in the United Nations? It's virtually 95% of all resolutions, there's almost a standing order there to hit Israel. There's only a few countries that actually stand against that. USA, Australia, maybe even New Zealand, I don't know. But certainly Australia, Canada and USA, I'm aware of, routinely and repeatedly stand against nearly every resolution that condemns Israel and the United Nations. So there is a very real sense in which all nations will be involved in this conflict. There will be a resolution, doubtless, in which the invasion of Israel will be sanctioned by the United Nations. And in that way, I think all nations will be involved in that. Now think about this. Here are the angels of God, and they've got these verses in front of them. I'm talking metaphorically, of course. And so a group of angels need to go and make sure that Judah returns in verse 1. Another group of angels got to make sure that Jerusalem's freed in verse 1. And another group of angels have to make sure that there's a body of people called the United Nations. So the angels are working to actually bring to pass these events. And the forethought of the providence of God to ensure this happens is astounding. The United Nations was born out of the ashes of World War II. World War II? Yes, the League of Nations in World War I, United Nations in World War II. We don't want any more world wars. But this body of people is going to sanction the next Middle East Armageddon war. All nations. Another little word, gather. Gather. I will gather. Without turning it up, what does Revelation 16:16 say? Don't look it up. Right, the frog spirit goes out and goes, I will gather all nations. Where's that language from? Joel chapter 3 and verse 2. The gathering of the nations. That's just a little word picked up in the New Testament, Revelation 16 verse 16. Those are the other Old Testament references if you want to make a note of that. We're not going to talk about those specifically this afternoon. But you see how the words of God are important. The concepts, God gathering all nations. Jehoshaphat means the judgment of God. The valley of Jehoshaphat, the judgment of God. So, Joel chapter 3 is a courtroom scene. Joel chapter 3 is a judge sitting before the gallery of the world, and the world is on trial. And the sentence is about to be passed, and judgment is about to be issued. That's the drama of Joel chapter 3, the valley of Jehoshaphat. And God says, I will plead with them there for my people and my heritage Israel. And that word plead, shafat, to judge, to pronounce sentence, by implication, to vindicate or punish. This is why it's called the Valley of Jehoshaphat, because the word plead is the word shafat, judge. Probably haven't seen Armageddon as a judgment in a courtroom, but that's the way in which it's presented. The nations are on trial for their lives. And the verdict, the end of verse 13, their wickedness is great, and therefore the punishment will be the destruction of all of that military might and evil. Their wickedness is great, guilty. That's the way the decision goes. What is the charge? Verse 2, I will plead with them there for my people and for my heritage Israel. Now, I want you to notice that. Israel are in unbelief. Some of Israel is back to the old Judaism of the New Testament, the Orthodox Jewish people. The rest of the nation is certainly hedonistic. And yet in verse 2, God calls them my people and my inheritance. That's a very wonderful thing for God still to recognize them as his people, despite their iniquity. The charge against the nations is that they have, whom they have scattered among the nations, and parted my land. So here's the charge. Two charges. Scattered the people among the nations and parted my land. Now, can you see the way Joel's working here. In Joel chapter 3, verse 1, God says, I will bring them out of captivity back into the land. The first charge is that these nations have taken the Jews and put them back into the nations. See that? And the rest of Joel, the few verses afterwards, are going to explain how the nations actually have taken the Jewish people and scattered them back into the world, some of them anyway. Okay? So the first charge is reversing the purpose of God. God's purpose in verse 1 is to bring them into the land, re-establish them, and the nation's purpose is to put them back into the world. That's charge number 1. The second is, parted my land. Now, as we have here, that phrase is used of the time when Joshua went into the land and parted the land. So, how do you think that section of the verse is going to be fulfilled in the lead up to Armageddon? What do you reckon? Palestinian state. Can you amplify that, Jimmy?
Giving Palestine to the land in.
Okay.
Broken up the land.
Okay. Let's build on that. Yep. What do you reckon?
Russia coming down and invading the land.
Yep. Yep. And yet, Jim, is there anyone talking? Any other ideas? I mean, I think those are right. Jason.
A lot of this already happened back in the 70s, though, right? And the land was parted and divided and kind of just given out to the.
In partition in 1947-48. Is that what you're saying?
In 1870. I'm talking about with the nation.
No, this is must be post 67. Because verse 1 locks the time period. In those days and in that time, when I bring again the captivity, I will bring all nations. So it's got nothing to do with 70. It's our time. So the question still stands, because this is the accusation that God is bringing against the nations. You've parted my land. Well, I think Jim is exactly right. Yep.
Well, if they've already reversed the captivity part, and we know the nation are trying to split Jerusalem right now, we're going to see a reversal of the Six-Day War.
Most likely. But the event of a Palestinian state in the mountains of Israel, which is my land, says God, could possibly be the way in which the nations part their land. They forcibly part my land, not Israel's land, God's land. He has designated this part of the land for Israel. Along come the nations and say, nope, this part is going to be for Israel, this part's going to be for everybody else. And the Jewish, the Palestinian state, or the push for Palestinian state, may be, in fact, the fulfillment of that, part my land. It certainly will be, as Jimmy said, when Russia comes in and just divides the land and conquers the land, the whole place will be just blown apart. Yep. So are you saying?
But the parting of the land has not happened yet.
Well, what do you think? Let's throw it back to the group here. What do you think? Has the parting of the land happened?
Yeah, Palestinians already have territory.
Yep, they do. They do, and perhaps the creation of a Palestinian state. Let's see if it happens. Maybe the final parting of the land, the official parting of the land, perhaps. Yeah, but the land is definitely divided at the moment. It's my land, says God, and Israel has not got all of it. So, in the back of your mind, keep your eyes and ears open as to what happens with the Palestinian state. Will it go ahead eventually? Will the land be parted? Will there be a political solution in which Israel is excluded from parts of the land? Let's wait and see. But we do know the second charge against the nations is they've parted my land. So let's be aware of that. Okay, verse 3.
Carl,
yep, sorry.
Brother Carl Perry has a book out on Joel.
Oh, yeah.
And in that...
I knew it'd come back to haunt me.
In that, he makes the comment that this word in verse 2, parted, the word parted is the same word rendered in Zechariah 14, verse 1, where it says, behold, the day of Yahweh cometh, and thy spoil shall be divided in the midst of thee. That word divided and this word parted are the same words.
So it's a division of the land, isn't it? A parting of the land. What a great comment. Okay. Now, this is the depravity of which the Russian troops get involved. They break open the vodka, manage to get a bottle of vodka in there, and they roll the dice, and they humiliate and abuse the defenseless in Israeli society. Now, that's the only little snapshot that Joel gives of this invasion of Israel by the Russian Confederacy. Just a little snapshot, but it's enough to tell us that these troops act like animals. I remember reading a commentary of the Russian invasion of Chechnya. And when they hit Chechnya, they did some unspeakable things when they took Chechnya. We're talking about Russian troops brutalizing the population of Israel. So it's not just a neat precision invasion, it is a humiliating, brutal invasion. And this little snapshot of these Russian troops just gambling, a girl for immoral purposes, a boy, yep, we'll send them off to captivity. And this is the charge, you have scattered my people among the nations. It starts with this concept of gambling for these boys and girls. And then in verse 4, God says, "Yea, and what have ye to do with me, O Tyre and Zidon, and all the coast of Palestine? Will you render me a recompense?" Now the word recompense means reward. What does this mean? Yea, what have you to do with me, Tyre and Zidon, and the coast of Palestine? Who are these people? And why are they attempting to offer God some type of reparation for what they've done? Well, the first point is this. Tyre and Zidon exist today in a country called Lebanon. Who controls Lebanon? Hezbollah. So how did the prophet know? Well, we know the answer to that, of course, it's through inspiration. How did the prophet know that there would be a group of people up there in Lebanon who would assist in the invasion? Moreover, that word Palestine is the Hebrew word Philistia. It's not Palestine, it's Philistia. Who's in the Gaza Strip? Hamas. Now, isn't that astounding? That the Word of God knows that in the invasion of Israel by this confederacy, there are two specific parts of the coast, Lebanon run by Hezbollah, Hamas running Gaza, that would be involved in that invasion. That is a staggering fulfillment of Bible prophecy. And that's why we will continue to see Hezbollah and Hamas continue to grow in their antagonism against Israel. And they have the audacity, in verse 4, to try and give God a recompense, try and make up for what they've done. And God says in verse 4, "If you recompense me swiftly and speedily, will I return your recompense upon your own head." How dare you attempt to try and make up for what you've done? If you attempt to do that, I will return that upon your head swiftly and speedily. And so we will continue to see Hamas and Hezbollah prosper, and they will assist that invasion, and they will do unspeakable things along with the Russian invasion. And they dare to offer God a recompense? And every time I hear news about Hamas and their evil and their anti-Semitism, it almost makes your blood boil. But God will deal with that in Armageddon. Let's see how he does that. Will you render me a recompense? No way. Now, Here's what they've done in verse 5. Because you have taken my silver and my gold and have carried into your temples my goodly pleasant things. In Ezekiel 38, we read the other day that Russia comes down with its confederacy to take a spoiler, to take a prey, silver and gold. What does Joel say? My gold, my silver. In what sense could that money belong to God?
It's his inheritance.
Yeah, and also because through his providence he made the Jewish state prosperous. Isn't it interesting that the money and the prosperity that God has given Israel, as soon as the nations start to touch that, God said, hey, that's mine. You're a bunch of thieves. This is mine. And the record says, you've carried into your temple my goodly, pleasant things. Rotherham says, my richly beautiful things. Young's literal, my desirable things that are good. And they go into their temples. That's the mosques. So the mosques will be used to store the plunder that Hamas and Hezbollah obtained through theft when they invade that land. This is very much up to date. Now, I must confess, I don't really know what those rich, beautiful things might be. So I'm going to throw it open to the group. What do you reckon those desirable things are that are going to end up in Arab mosques? I'm open to suggestions because I don't really know.
Historical Jewish artifacts or something like that?
Historical Jewish artifacts? That's not a bad suggestion, yeah. Maybe worth a lot of money, Nathaniel?
Well, that would just be kind of like in the time of Babylon, not Nebuchadnezzar, but time of Babylon, they're using the gold goblets and drinking from them.
Yep. Kind of remind me of that. Could be. Any other suggestions?
I mean, I don't have the ability to search. Is there an echo to anywhere else in Scripture about really pleasant things?
I couldn't find one, but yeah, Jimmy.
Faithful people.
People? I hadn't seen as people. I don't know whether it would encompass that. I get the idea of objects of art, perhaps. Like Tim suggested, perhaps. So anyway, that's interesting. To keep something in mind, that there's something in the Jewish state that's desirable by the Arabs. Yep.
I was just thinking about people. I mean, they, in Islam, they used to force people to convert or else. So maybe people they brought into their
The reason why I think that's the reason why I think that's doubtful is because of the verses that follow, which we'll see in a moment, because it does talk about people. But I'm seeing here, perhaps objects of art, objects of antiquity. It may even be relics of archaeology, which are valuable. I don't really know. But we do know that when that invasion happens, it's like the looting that happens, after warfare. That people go lawless and go crazy and they loot shops and they loot houses. And all that stuff gets dumped into the mosques, your temples. Isn't that interesting? And Hamas and Hezbollah are behind that. So they're thieves.
Carl, in Psalm 83,
yep.
When it lists those nations, it says the nations that they have said, come and let us cut them off from being a nation. The name of Israel may be no more in remembrance. And it goes down a little bit and it says, who says, let us take to ourselves the houses of God in possession. Is there houses of worship? I have no idea. Is there houses of worship ornate and gaudy and?
Well, certainly synagogues are considered to be that, aren't they?
Are they? I don't know. Yeah. Are they like? Do they have jewels and?
Yes.
Stuff like
yeah.
That?
Yeah. I mean, there are Jewish artifacts which are quite quite sort of priceless. Maybe it's those kind of things. Yeah. Yep. Interesting. Now this is. This is the charge explained. You scattered my people among the nations, and Hamas and Hezbollah are in the thick of things. Let's read verse 6. The children also of Judah and the children of Jerusalem have you sold to the Grecians that you might remove them far from their border. There is going to be mass deportations of Jewish people from the land. And the rounding up of the sons of Judah and the sons of Jerusalem and being sold to the sons of Greece. So what is happening is that the nations are going to solve the Jewish problem and the Jewish question by deporting the population of Jews. And massive numbers are going to be taken, rounded up, and deported back into Europe. The sons of Greece. Jimmy.
I might be taking a step backwards here.
Yep.
Can you just highlight for me where this fits in the timeline of what we're looking at with Daniel chapter 11 and Armageddon and
okay.
What we're looking at here?
All right. These are the events which are happening as a result of Armageddon. So Armageddon is Russia takes the city. Daniel 11 says he puts the tabernacle of his palaces between the two seas. At some point of taking Jerusalem, there will be Armageddon of all nations involved in that conflict, of which Russia will remain dominant. As a result of that victory, these things will happen. Deportation of the Jews, abuse of the Jews.
So this is going to happen while Russia
correct.
Has control.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. Yep, that's fine. Thank you for that. Yep, this is while Russia has control, deporting Jews. And Hamas and Hezbollah will be rubbing their hands in glee at deporting all these Jews. And Europe will take them, the sons of the Grecians, the sons of Greece, not necessarily the country Greece, but the sons of Greece was the European southern section of the Mediterranean. So they'll go to Italy, Turkey, Greece, France, all those southern coasts, deported. Notice how the sons of Judah and the sons of Jerusalem are two different groups of people. So the population of Israel in the country proper and also the captivity of Jerusalem. Now, yep.
And are these then the details of the two charges we talked about?
Yes.
So this is
yes.
Sort of explaining
yes.
Why.
Okay. Yes. Yep, this is the evidence. Okay, I'm pleading with Israel. You scatter the nations, part of my land. This is what you've done. Let me give the evidence. And now we're going back into the drama of all that. This is what you've been doing, scattering my people. Now, Zechariah 14 says that half the city shall go forth into captivity. Why do you think half the city only? What about the whole city? Sorry? Zechariah 14 says half the city, Jerusalem, shall go into captivity. My question is, why not the whole city? Why just half the city? Exactly. That to me is the implication. And we were discussing that the other day, Neil. Whilst Israel holds Jerusalem, Luke 21:24, clearly to me, half of Jerusalem is inhabited by non-Jews, and they're permitted to remain in the city. But the other half, the Jewish half, into captivity. And that's why I see the implication of that. So I think probably, most likely, we'll see Jerusalem still divided, certainly owned by Israel, but it'll be half population by Jews and half populated by Arabs. Okay, just an implication. Now, you multiply that scene across thousands and thousands of people and the organization needed to round these people up, this will be almost like the ghettos of World War II. Remember the Nazis rounding up the prisoners and herding them off? You know, there'll be an awful link through here. How many Jews will die in Armageddon? What's the population of Israel at the moment? With Arabs, it's about 9 million. So say the population of Israel is, say, 6, 7 million Jews. We're talking about 4 million Jews dying. 4 million. These are the people of God. And of the 2 million left, there's a huge, massive deportation of these Jews, rounding them up like the Nazis did in World War II. It will be absolutely frightening. Absolutely frightening. And we're just giving just a few little hints here and there in the record of God. It is frightening stuff. But that is the method by which God will refine these people. Chris?
So, at what point does Christ's feet stand on the Mount of Olives?
Okay, let's throw it back to the group. At what point does Christ stand on the Mount of Olives?
When they flee and they cry out.
Right, but I think the question was at what point in the process of Armageddon, is that what you're saying? Okay. Well, we're not told precisely how long Russia has control of that whole land. There must be sufficient time to come down the coast, Daniel 11, come back up, take Jerusalem, defeat the Western forces, consolidate power in Jerusalem. How long that takes, we're not told in Scripture. But then at some point, at the end of that whole campaign, the Lord intervenes. Nathan.
Do you perceive that that defeated the Western forces already by now?
Yep.
How do we know that?
Well, we see Daniel 11 says that the reason why Russia comes back up from Egypt is because there are tidings out of the north and the east. So there's a military activity which is actually trying to defend Jerusalem and trying to shore up those defences. That brings Russia up from Egypt, and there's Armageddon. In fact, Armageddon likely has a series of different campaigns. There could be one in the region of Jordan, Bosra. That's one campaign. Another will be in Jerusalem. And that's Jerusalem one is the Armageddon. All nations against Jerusalem, the battle. Yep.
So to be clear, this is after Armageddon or during Armageddon?
What, this verse?
This, yes.
Well, there has to be sufficient time for Russia to consolidate his power and do that. Okay? Now, the exact sequence of whether they do that having taken Jerusalem or after they defeated the Allies, we don't know. But they'll have sufficient consolidation of power and then Christ will strike. Now, time frame, we're not told. Weeks, months, I don't know. Tony?
Yeah, maybe to get to the answer to that question, Zechariah says, just starting in the middle of verse 2, it says, you know, the women ravished, half the city shall go forth into captivity, residue of the people shall not be cut off from the city. Then shall Yahweh go.
That's right.
Fight as he did in the
days of. Yep. And my take is that after Russia has defeated the Western powers, this will happen. But does it mean another Western force in Jerusalem? I don't know. Jason?
I've understood the tidings of Adam and Mark in the East to be referring to the March of the Rainbow Angel.
That is one explanation of that. In fact, when you read Brother Thomas's works, he's got both views. Yeah, March the Rainbow Angel. Don't worry, he's just showing off. No. Yeah, no, just ignore that comment. All right.
An interesting thing, Carl, is that these events that we're talking about, they are events that will take time to begin.
Yeah.
Christ comes and interrupts it and puts everything right, but these things will have already begun. They will already have been. And one of the things that is always said by people, Jewish people that are involved in any sort of movie or documentary or interview or any project that has to do with Jews and the Holocaust, they always say the reason we do this is so that it will never happen again.
Yep.
And it's all going to happen again.
All going to happen again.
They
all going to happen again.
No idea what's coming.
Exactly. Yep, Nathaniel.
Well, that's why I'm trying to get a visual of this, and it seems like there had to be a whole. I mean, America aren't going to stand by, or the allies of Israel. There's going to have to be a full-on war, and Russia are going to have to take that land.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's what Armageddon is, isn't it? All nations against Jerusalem to battle. But whether this comes and precipitates America's response, or America's still getting itself organized, or America is still rubbing its wounds because it's been defeated somewhere, we just don't know that detail. That's military detail we don't know. All we know is the results of this vision tell us that at some point there's that going to happen.
Do you say America is going to stand by because they are the young lions that say they come and take a spoil?
I don't think they're going to be involved. I don't think they're going to come at all.
Okay. Can we throw that back to the group? What do you think of that idea?
We get Democratic presidents who don't want to fight.
Okay. Let's talk about that one. What do you reckon?
So what you're saying is that you don't think that the young lions...
I think the Russians will come. The young lions are not going to come.
You don't think the tidings from the east and the north of the young lives are refortifying Jerusalem after Russia's come down.
Okay, well, look, I'm happy to debate that, but I'd like to get through Joel and Olivet Prophecy first. I'm happy to come back to that and talk about that, okay? But can we move on?
Yeah, I just have one quick question. Why did our Lord tell us to pray for the peace of Jerusalem? Why did he not say, pray for the sweetie destruction and restoration of Jerusalem?
All right. What do you think?
Ezekiel 38 says they have unwalled villages, so we need to pray for them to get to a point where they are taking their walls down.
But he said pray for the peace of Jerusalem.
Pray for the peace. Yeah, come to the peace and tear their walls down.
That's the ultimate result that we hope for, though.
But Christ wouldn't have said, pray for this, if he wouldn't have expected us to believe that the praying could in some way affect these things. You know, when he says, pray that your flight may not be in winter. Why would he say, pray that your flight not be in winter, if your prayers could have an effect on the season when that nation would come?
Okay, look, I'm happy to reconvene this debate because I think it's important we get through that. But I would love to get through the session and just paint what Joel has to say and what the prophet has to say, and then we can come back to that. Okay? So I don't want to sideline it permanently. I want to come back later on, if that's okay. But those are all good issues. I'm happy to talk those through. Okay, let's come back to Joel chapter 3. The charge, you've scattered my people among the nations. This is how it's going to happen. Okay? And this Holocaust will occur, 4 million Jews. Now, think about this. If God is going to permit 2/3 of Israel to be destroyed, what do you think the judgments on the world are going to be like? If 2/3 of Israel, his own people, have to go through this to be refined, what about the world? Population of the world is?
7 billion,
did someone say? It's a huge number. And you do 2/3 of that, and you realize that is an awful amount of destruction. Awful amount of destruction.
It says the slain of Yahweh will be from one end of the earth
to the other. Yeah. Awful. You going to say something?
Where do you get the 2/3?
Ah, I was waiting for that question. Where do we get the 2/3 from? Sorry?
Zechariah 13.
It is Zechariah 13. Can I come back to that later? Well, look, we need a whole discussion on this Armageddon thing, okay? And we will get there. But the purpose of these talks is to show you what comes before Armageddon so you can expect to look for certain things before Armageddon. But we'll talk about 2/3 later on. Good. These are good questions. Excellent questions. So, you have removed my people, Hezbollah and Hamas and all that invasion. And God says, I'm going to respond in verse 7, behold, I will raise them up out of the place whither you have sold them and will return your recompense upon your own head. So, I will raise them out of the place whither you have sold them. That's the second Exodus. That's bringing these Jews back. You've sold them. You've made money out of it. I'm bringing them back. Now, who is the I of that verse that will accomplish that? Sorry? It is God, but it could be us. That verse is talking about a future group of people, the saints of God, who will be involved in bringing those people back. And some of us here, God willing, accepted by God, in the mercy of God, could be in that group of saints to do that. You group here, I want you to go to Italy and bring them back. You group there, France, China, Australia, New York, wherever it may be. Bring them back. You sold them, I'm bringing them back. And I'm going to return your recompense upon your own head. I will sell your sons and your daughters into the hand of the sons of Judah, and they shall sell them to the Sabaeans, to people afar off. So what will happen is that Hamas, Hezbollah, the Arabs that have been involved in this awful deportation of Jews, God is actually going to sell them, metaphorically, into a far country. In other words, God is going to solve the Palestinian problem by deporting all those Arabs who have participated in that invasion. He is going to remove them out of the land. They will not be worthy to stay in that land. Yep.
Who are the Sabaeans again?
Okay, next slide. Okay, concept. You've deported all my people. I'm going to return the recompense. You dare try and make up for what you've done. My solution to you is I'm going to get rid of you and send you right out of the land. You don't deserve to be in this land. And that will solve the Palestinian problem once and for all, because there will be no Palestinians. All those Arabs that have participated and rejoiced in that will be gone.
So that really fits, because the land has to be from the Euphrates to the Nile.
Exactly.
All that land has to be given to the Jewish people.
Exactly.
Their tribal allotments.
Yep, exactly right. So the question is, who are the Sabaeans? Good question. There is, the word Sabaeans actually appears in Isaiah 45. However, it's a different word, so you can't make any link to Isaiah 45. Point number one. Point number two, the Sabaeans of Joel 3 and verse 8, which is what we're in at the moment, are descendants of Sheba, the grandson of Abraham and Keturah. Where is Sheba today? Near Saudi Arabia. What's west of Saudi Arabia on that peninsula? Starts with Y, ends in N. Yemen. Well done. Good guess. The Sheba of Scripture, the spice area of Sheba, the Sabaeans, far off, will actually be the area of Yemen, around that area there, which is as far away from Israel in an Arab context as you can get. They're still allowed to live in the mercy of God. They're still allowed to stay somewhere in the mercy of God, but it's nowhere near those cantons in Israel. They'll be deported right to the southern tip of the Saudi Arabian Peninsula. That's where Sabaea is. It's interesting with Sabaea. The Sabaean kingdom was located in now what is called southwest Yemen. And in ancient times, southwest Yemen through here, kingdom of Sheba, was in fact quite a sophisticated society. Temples, castles, myrrh and frankincense, which were the valuable spices of the age. They had the monopoly on all of that perfume industry. It was big dollars. And because I didn't know much about Sheba, I just thought I'd just throw a few slides up. And Psalm 72 tells us that Sheba will actually subject itself to Christ. The kings of Sheba. So Yemen at the moment, which is in a real mess, and the Prime Minister of Yemen, who was recently recovering in Saudi hospital from wounds because of a terrorist attack, who I think is back, if he's still around the place, he will submit himself to Christ. And it's an amazing place. I got a couple of shots of this part of Sheba. I didn't know anything about this particular place until I looked at it. But it's quite a unique place. I just thought it was just desert with a bit of sea. But there's highlands, and you need these highlands for the spice growth. So that's where they're going to enjoy their captivity.
What was the verse reference?
I don't know about enjoy. I'm sorry? It's got Psalm 72. Yeah, I use the word enjoy in a sarcastic way. Okay, so Hamas will still remain, Hezbollah will still remain, therefore, unfortunately for Israel, and unfortunately for current events, that antagonism will continue. In verse 9, proclaim ye this among the Gentiles, prepare war, wake up the mighty men, let the men of war draw near, let them come up. That therefore means what must happen before Armageddon. Sorry?
Militarization.
Defense spending will increase. Technology will increase. Preparation for war will increase. War academies will be bursting with new cadets, and so on and so on and so on. Why do we see this massive militarization? Because Joel 3 verse 9 said, there's a proclamation going out, prepare war. And that's why we see this tremendous sense of military buildup. Okay, the rest of the chapter is Armageddon and some of the events that occur. I just want to draw your attention to two more verses, verse 15 and verse 16. The sun and the moon shall be darkened, and the stars shall withdraw their shining. Yahweh also shall roar out of Zion and utter his voice from Jerusalem, and the heavens and the earth shall shake. But Yahweh will be the hope of his people and the strength of the children of Israel. Now, in verse 15, who do you think the sun, moon, and stars are that are darkened by this event?
Political powers.
The Jewish powers?
Political powers.
Yep. Jewish political powers?
Sure.
I agree. It's called leading the witness. Now, why am I highlighting that? Because we're going to come across this language in the Olivet Prophecy, sun, moon, stars being darkened. And the clear implication is, is that for the stars and sun to be darkened, what must happen before that event occurs? The sun, the moon, the stars must be relit again, mustn't they? That's logical. If they're going to be darkened in Armageddon, they must be alive and well prior to Armageddon. Yes, makes sense? Okay. Keep that in mind, because we'll come to that in the Olivet Prophecy. All right. Any questions or comments, apart from the Armageddon side of things, which we'll deal with later, any questions or comments on what we've dealt with so far?
What's the time frame of when there will be sold to the Sabaeans?
Time frame for what, sorry, Chris?
Well, it says, and then they will sell them to the Sabaeans. What's the time frame?
Not given.
Not given.
Not given.
We don't know.
No.
We don't know who's in power at the time.
Oh, Christ will be in power.
Okay.
Yep. But how long it'll take, we don't know. The second Exodus will take many years. 40 years. So part of that second Exodus will be to bring these Jews back. Yep. Okay. Let's take a break. After break, we'll deal with the Olivet Prophecy. Back in 15 minutes. Thank you.